welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. This week we're covering the Wind and Truth preview chapters number three, chapters three and four. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing excellent. Thanks for asking. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. These chapters were a little different this week, so should be interesting to talk about.
We got direct answers to questions we asked last episode already. So I'm excited to talk about that. Let's roll intro and get right into it. All right. Where else to start besides the epigraphs? Would either of you like to read the epigraphs, or shall I?
I'd like to read them. The wind told me before she vanished that it was the change in Odium's vessel that restored her voice. I wonder, perhaps it is the new storm making people begin to reconsider that the wind is not their enemy. I have read that in the ancient days, the wind often spoke to both human and singer. It would then mean that the wind stopped talking not because of Odium, but because of people who began to fear her, or to worship the storm instead.
Several things in there. So, David, you appear to be right that this is like the wind spren, like capital W wind spren, right? Like that's how I interpreted it.
Yeah, I was ready to come in here going, I think I was right.
I think you were. Yeah.
I was ready to be contradicted if you guys had other opinions, but
no, that's definitely the way I'm leaning. And so, well, I'm going to start with the first one, and I want you guys to confirm or deny if I'm reading this correctly. The wind told me before she vanished that it was the change in Odium's vessel that restored her voice. So I'm making two big assumptions there. A, this is Kaladin. Like, this is almost certainly Kaladin. B, before she vanished, meaning she's going to vanish, because this is after Odium's vessel is changed. So this is not like long past. This is today or yesterday. She comes back and she will vanish.
Yeah.
The timeline of when this was written and when they're talking about, it's hard to wrap my head around right now.
Yeah.
So I think I agree with you.
Unless we're being like greatly misled, which is totally possible. Like if there was an Odium vessel swap long in the past, maybe this could be a different author. But assuming we're talking about Raze and Teravangian, I would assume this has to be somebody that's being talked. Somebody, the wind is talking to someone, whether that be Kaladin or otherwise, and then the wind will vanish between when the epigraph was written and when the vessel left.
Mm-hmm. I will say that we pretty much have confirmed that Raze is the original vessel of Odium.
Yeah.
Like, at least that's what Hoid seems to believe, and I don't know why he would be wrong about that. Because of the letters, right?
Right.
Yeah.
In the letters, he's like, Raze before he ascended was blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. And I do think we're talking about the change from Raze to Teravangian. And we know Teravangian's made several changes, like bringing back El, for example. So maybe one of the changes is he, you know, stops suppressing the Windspren for whatever reason. And it's hard because there's Windspren and then there's the Wind Spren.
Yeah, well, there's Honor Spren, which are tied to the wind. And then there's Wind Spren, and then there's the Wind Spren. So three separate categories here.
I'm still not 100% on board with this being Kaladin. I think we're meant to believe it's Kaladin, but
for sure,
you know, Alendi versus Rashek still rattles around in my head. So
that's a really good point. It is definitely the difference between Raze and Teravangian. or somehow maybe some future change there, but I think that's extremely unlikely. I still think you have good merit with this possibly being the wind being one of the unmade that have been corrupted.
Okay.
And it being somehow a part of that. I didn't do a deeper dive into the unmade though, and I just off the top of my head, I don't think any of their powers would really align with the wind. And what do you guys think of that?
So the only thing I had to go on with the unmade were once like the original Night Radiant spread, and then they've been corrupted since. I wonder if the unmade, which each represent like carnality at some level, like there's, I need to brush up on my unmade, but there's the Heart of the Revel, which is all about like gluttony and, you know, and fully satisfying your carnal pleasures. And then there's, you know, Diagon Arthas, that's like a twisted version of fear and sorrow and, you know, that type of thing, where there are emotions that in moderation could be fine, but they've been taken at such an extreme that they've been twisted into the unmade. So that the reason why I thought that is that, what if the original Spren were the moderation version of that, where like instead of the Heart of the Rebel being gluttony, it was health, you know, like this could be an Edge Dancer Spren about health and restoration and feasting, you know. And then if you, an Odium twists it into the Heart of the Rebel, which is all about satiating your lusts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think, David?
I think I understand your theory. I don't necessarily agree with it. I think it is fine. I really still... Well, let me read this from chapter 4, because I think this is important to the conversation. So let me just bring it on board here. So Kaladin asks Wit, is the wind a god? And Wit replies, when this world was created, long before honor, cultivation, or odium arrived, Adonalsium left something behind on it. Sometimes it's called the old magic. Sometimes that term is applied to the Night Watcher, who came with cultivation's efforts from one of those ancient Spren. Listen to the wind when it speaks, Kaladin. It's weaker than it once was, but it has seen so very much. So what I get out of this is the old magic is Adonalsium's magic that he left on this world, and he created a bunch of Spren. Because he created a Spren that then became the Night Watcher under cultivation's influence. And then I think he created a bunch of Spren, which then became unmade by Odium. So, you know, cultivation did one, and Odium did 9, right? There's 9 unmade.
Well, and then
honor
and cultivation together would make the sibling, perhaps.
Yeah. So these were not. Well, the thing is, some of it is them making splinters off of themselves, but I think some of it is Adonalsium splinters, if that's right. A thing. So the wind being, so the old magic is not honor's magic or cultivation's magic or odium's magic. I thought it was cultivation's magic up until this sentence that I read. And I was like, it's Adonalsium's magic that he left behind on Roshar. Because Adonalsium created Roshar. So that's very interesting to me. And I think that there were a bunch of these big, powerful Spren on Roshar. And all of the shards came by and corrupted them in some way. We only think of corruption as like something Odium does, but I'm sure all the shards can do it and did do it. So
does the Stormfather say he's created by Odium? I'm sorry, by Honor, or is he like adopted by Honor to serve him? Did the Stormfather pre-exist Honor?
The storm did.
I do know the Stormfather does say in Words of Radiance that he's what's left behind from Honor, like the almost like the image left behind now that he's gone. That doesn't have to mean he came from Honor.
Sure.
Yeah, I think with the Stormfather specifically, it's a little bit confusing because he's like three different things all at once. He's very different than he was before Honor died. So, because he's like, he's holding at least like the cognitive shadow of Tanavast plus whatever he was before, plus whatever else Honor did to him. So, I mean, there's just a lot going on with Stormfather that mm-hmm. we see now.
Because with these epigraphs, I would almost use the term like Wind Mother, like the Stormfather, and then there's some spren of the wind that's like of Roshard, not of one of our shards, right? So I would venture to use that term coupled with the Storm Father.
Yeah. Yeah, I could totally see that. And this, I put a little bit of this in the outline, but there are a couple different things that really come to mind, especially from the chapter 4 epigraph where he says the wind stopped talking, not because of Odium, but because of the people who began to fear her or to worship the storm instead. I know fear and worship often go very hand in hand. And there can be a fear that's, you know, very bad, scary. There can be a fear that's good, like a fear of fire, of getting burned. It's like a healthy understanding of consequences for actions. And that kind of relates to Spren and whether they're able to be, what's the word, sapient? And like their level of sapience is really related to how people think of them. And if they're thinking in fear and worshiping, they're like giving power in some ways, or at least sapience to these beings. And then on another level, it reminds me of Rick Riordan's, the Lightning Thief. And quick spoilers for that, if you care. But in that, they have the Greek gods, which are the older ones, and then the Roman gods, which are the newer ones. And as the people stopped focusing on the Greeks and they focused on the Romans, the beings changed, and all of a sudden they didn't really have power. They, like, this side lost power, this side gained power. And it seems like it's a very similar thing happening here with the wind versus the storm. And then a fourth layer, I'm talking too much here. A fourth layer, I'm wondering about the power that Ad-Nauseam left behind. Did he give it shape, like the wind, the storm father, say the wind mother, or is that something that only emerged over time? All of these things are popping around. What do you guys think?
Do you mind if I go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm reminded of another novel by Terry Pratchett called Small Gods. And this isn't really a spoiler. It's kind of the plot, which is that in that world, a god is as powerful as how many people worship that god and believe in that god. And there's one god, a turtle god, who has one worshiper left. And if that worshiper dies, then the god also dies. And so he's trying very hard to keep this worshiper alive throughout the book. But he's not very powerful because he has one worshiper. So this kind of feels similar to like this sentence about Spren. We know Spren are created by the general thoughts of sentient beings around them, making them take form and shape. So yeah, these are all very interesting questions, Tim. And I think I agree that they're interesting ideas. And so I'm wondering if the speculation about, you know, is it because people began to fear her, or is it because they worship the storm instead? Is it just a collective loss of consciousness about the existence of this Windspren thus the Windspren lost the ability to speak because of that. Like, is it a little bit more innocent than like, we fear her, we want to banish her? Because think, you know, people fear the unmade, and I think that just makes them stronger, right? Fearing something does make you think, it still implies that it exists.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just forget about it, to be forgotten, that's kind of the final death, right? So maybe the wind was forgotten because all these other Spren were so much more visible and less subtle.
It says the wind often spoke to both human and singer. It would then mean that the wind stopped talking, not because of odium, but because of people who began to fear her. That people is doing some odd work there, because it originally says human and singer, but then it says people. Does that refer to both?
I would assume so.
I would think it's a collective term for both sentient beings types. Okay.
So, and then it says, or to worship the storm instead. Because, so does that mean that both human and singer were then worshiping the storm instead? Like both turn their back on the wind, for a lack of a better term?
That really sparks something in my head. I hadn't even thought about this till you talked about that, Trevor. But there's kind of the story about how the singers first were kind of paired with the Spren, and then the Spren betrayed the singers because they liked how their bonds with humans were stronger and gave them more abilities, or whatever the reason was. Right. But basically, and then the singers sought out Odium because they needed forms, and you know, they no longer had the sentient Spren forms. And so I guess what I'm getting at with that is, what if something predates even that, and it used to be the old magic that prevailed in the lands, and you know, singers are native to Roshar, meaning, at least in my head, that means Adonalsium created the singers.
I would agree.
And he would, they depend on some kind of magic system with their gem hearts to have forms. So what did that look like pre-honor and pre-cultivation? Were they using the old magic? Were they using Adonalsium type Spren to do that? That's kind of my thought there. And so then when they moved on and were like, ooh, we like these forms that these new Spren can give us, and then ultimately what Odium can give us with his Spren, they kind of forgot about the old ways that they gained forms through, you know, like the wind and other old magic.
I think you're onto something there. I also think it could be in this quote that one side feared the wind because of the divisions between humans and singer, and then the other side turned to worship the storm and said, looking for power or something along the lines of what you're saying, to bridge that gap or that divide. Maybe the wind was trying to play an intermediary and it got burned.
That would have to be the storm father, right? The high storm, because the Everstorm didn't exist previously.
Yes. So maybe they used to use the wind to change forms, and then they started using the storm instead.
Mm. Well, that's how the singers do now, right?
Yeah.
When it comes to the Way of Kings, they go out in the high storm and change forms.
And now they use the Everstorm.
Right.
But maybe they originally used the wind through the old magic. They used the wind, and then they discovered, ooh, now we can use the storm. Maybe after honor and cultivation arrive, the storm is a better way for them to gain powerful forms. That's my thought right now. And so I really like what you said, Tim, is it's not one or the other. It's humans feared the wind because the singers could use the wind and the humans couldn't. And then with the singers, they started worshiping the storm and using the storm for their magic instead of using the wind. And then the wind was forgotten.
I think there's another section that's really relevant to this. a little bit further on where we're talking about the Hoid and Kaladin are talking, and we get to the Wander Sail and the tune that Kaladin learns there, and how that is one of the pure tones of Roshar. And he's talking about Roshar listening, and when he's playing the song, and he stops playing and the song keeps on going, that's Roshar responding. This got me asking tons of other questions, but specifically related to what we're talking about right now with the wind. My thought just went away, but there's definitely a connection there. Do you guys see what I'm reaching for?
Yeah, and I want to point out that I think it was implied, and I could try to find the quote, but I do think it was implied that Wit's music system uses the tones of Audel Nalsium.
Oh.
So maybe there were 16, maybe their scale, you know, their musical scale is 16 notes instead of 12. And there's one tone per what eventually splintered, you know, whatever shattered from Audel Nalsium. And so when he plays his music using those pure tones, they resonate with the original creations of Audel Nalsium.
Yeah. So this is maybe backtracking a little bit, but it'll tie in, I promise. In Mistborn, at the end of Mistborn, it explicitly says that ruin and preservation created the humans on Scadrial. If we're making the assumption that the singers are made by Audel Nalsium, which I think is a good assumption to make, I think that is solid based on what we know. Were the humans that ended up on Roshar created by Audel Nalsium or created by a shard? I don't know if we have a good answer to that, but
yeah, I mean, we know that Hoid's human race from why am I blanking on the name? Someone help me. From Yolin.
Yeah, Yolin.
They were created by Audel Nalsium, because that's even told to us in Mistborn. I think Hero of Ages epigraphs. I could try to find it, but basically in my memory, it's like humans already existed, were created by Audel Nalsium, and then when Ruin and Preservation went and created Scadrial, they then created humans in the same image as essentially themselves, right? Who were created, sure, by Audel Nalsium. So I'm trying to remember what your specific question was.
So from the humans that end up on Roshar, they crash land on Shinovar from wherever burning planet they're running from. Were those humans originally created by Audel Nalsium or by a shard? And I don't think we can have the answer to that right now, but I think that may matter if Kaladin is to, you know, speak directly with Roshar or Honor or Tanavast, or like, you know how both Dalinar and Kaladin are sons of Honor, but only Kaladin is son of Tanavast? Like, then there's a specific difference there, but we haven't been told what it is. That's kind of the what I'm running down with here. Is the wind going to talk to only a certain person, maybe the son of Tanavast, or instead of like a son of Audel Nalsium?
Yeah, it could be. And that reminds me of the old bloods. Like, you remember Teleb is considered one of the old bloods.
Yeah.
And that hasn't, nothing has come from that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that, I think that there's a purpose behind it, and it might end up being just this tiny little thing that we learn about later. But maybe that could tie into it. And there's a connection. There are some people that were perhaps created through a shard, and some people that came from Yolin. And there's an intermingling there.
I will say I could easily create a hypothetical timeline that would make the humans on Roshar be original Audel Nalsium humans. And that timeline would be something happens to Yolin. humans spread across the galaxy fleeing Yolen. Some of them end up on Ashen. They destroy Ashen. They end up on Roshar.
True.
So that's easily a possibility. I don't think Odium created humans, if that's the question. I don't see how that timeline works out.
Well, and the humans originally had Odium with them. They brought Odium with them, yes? Because Honor and Cultivation were originally on Roshar, and the humans brought Odium with them.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out the timeline there, because Odium went around the Cosmere splintering a bunch of shards before he ended up in the Rosharan system. But yeah, definitely he sat on Ashen for a while, basically giving void binding powers to the humans, is my understanding. And then they used those void binding powers to destroy their entire planet, and then came to Roshar, where Odium followed. That's my understanding, although that's piecing together a lot of like really cryptic stuff that we've learned. But
right,
yeah, that's my understanding as well. It's more of an opportunity that Odium took up.
Let's move to this Shallan chapter, and then we'll end with our Wander Sail callback, which I am very excited about. But Shallan and Adolin are chatting with Wit in Lasting Integrity, and there's a one-liner of the Windrunners are on their way to pick them up, and they'll be there like that day. And I was like, oh, that's really convenient to go get our heroes within a day, Brandon. Okay, cool, whatever. Yeah. Like it didn't really bother me, but I was just like, okay. But they talk with Kalek. Kalek tells them that Ba'ed O'Mishram, which we talked at length last episode, two episodes ago.
Yeah.
Ba'ed O'Mishram is in the spiritual realm. And Pattern goes on this little diatribe about how if you thought Shadesmar was weird, the spiritual realm is on the 10th dimension weirder. And the gods live there, and even the gods don't understand it. Are we going to the spiritual realm in this book, gentlemen?
Definitely. I don't know what it means to go to the spiritual realm, but I'm interested in finding out what's going on in Sanderson's head about that. Because I always thought, and I was having this discussion on the Discord, but I always thought that the spiritual realm didn't even have the concept of space and time. So like, how do you go somewhere that doesn't have space and time? And how do you look for something somewhere that doesn't have space and time? But it may be that I'm not quite understanding what that means, because I'm sort of thinking about it from like a physics perspective of like, well, if you don't have up, down, left, right, forward, back, you don't have yesterday and tomorrow, like how do you exist in there in the first place, right?
Well, I think that's what Adolin says as well. Like, what is it? I don't understand what we're talking about. What do you mean? And I think Sanderson put that line in there to say that, like, I get that you guys don't understand what I'm saying here. Just hold on. It'll be fine, I promise. But yeah, like going to the spiritual realm, I never considered as an option until this chapter. So hiding Ba'ed O'Mishram in the spiritual realm, like they say in the chapter, what does that even mean? What does that entail? How do we get there? Because so for a long time I had the misconception that the spiritual realm was the beyond, and those were the same two things. But you know, after rereading Mistborn and having all that explained to me again, I understand that that's separate. However, Dalinar specifically talks to Evie, and she's in the spiritual realm, correct? That's what we're told at the end of Oathbringer, because she forgives him. She says, "I forgive you," and it's at the end of Oathbringer.
Yeah, same as TN's conversation with Kaladin at the end of Rhythm of War. I don't know that I can explain it. I don't know that anyone can, but my thought is that this is left up to the philosophers, right? Where we're probably not getting an answer to what actually happened, because there's sort of the kind of science, you know, I don't even know if scientific is the right word, because science if magic actually exists, science would be able to describe it. But sort of the skeptical position would be, this is something happening in their heads. The sort of a little bit less skeptical version would be, because when you access the spiritual realm, there's no such thing as the past and the future. It's all kind of wound together. They could literally be accessing kind of a future version of the past person as predicted by the spiritual realm in a different time branch. Like, I don't know, like, or even just talking to the past version of that.
A little bit more simplified version. Let me try. What if it all has to do with connection? If you still have a connection to that person, you can then contact them via the spiritual realm, or who they would be at in the spiritual realm. Because it explicitly says that Tien is full grown in this conversation that he has with Kaladin at the end of Rhythm of War. So I'm wondering if you still have a connection with that person, Dalinar to Evie, Kaladin to Tien, you know, et cetera, et cetera, Kalak to Ba'ir Mishram, if you can utilize that capital C connection, or a bondsmith can utilize that capital C connection to then go have a chat.
I would say, yeah, you brought up a really good point. And I think maybe what fuels the spiritual realm is connection, almost. Like, instead of, like, because when they're saying there's no concepts of space and time, like, instead, connection is the way you traverse the spiritual realm. And it would make sense then that trapping Ba'ir Mishram there, who is, I believe, all about connection, is that what then really soiled things for Roshar?
Yeah.
I want to kind of enumerate what I do know about the spiritual realm, because maybe it'll help kind of ground things. One thing is, we know the shards exist almost entirely in the spiritual realm. And the spiritual realm is the source of all investiture, and it's where all investiture goes when it's used. So it's kind of recycled. So when they say there's infinite investiture in the spiritual realm, I think what it really means is that you can't run out of it, because as soon as you use it, it goes back to the spiritual realm. The other thing we know is that when Odium splintered shards, sometimes he would shove them into the cognitive realm, and sometimes he'd shove them into the physical realm. And as a result, they would get recycled into the spiritual realm. So those are kind of the things I know about it. There's also the thing Shallan does when she draws someone.
Yes.
Where she's kind of accessing almost an alternate version of someone, which kind of ties into what I was talking about with Tien and Evie. But yeah, I mean, I think connection is a big part of all that.
Yeah, I think connection makes a lot of sense, that it's going to be very well integrated. Like Sezed says, he was able to contact Vin and Ellen.
Oh, yeah.
So there had to be some sort of way of doing that. I remember when I first read that, I assumed he just talked with them in the cognitive realm before they left. But thinking about it now, I think it's like he was able to talk to them to the beyond.
I don't know that we cleared up any confusion, but...
Yeah,
for sure.
So now that we still know nothing about the spiritual realm, how do we get Ba'ir Mishram out of the spiritual realm? I mean, we could hypothesize about this one all day.
Yeah.
Doink.
Just unzip the curtain, pull it back, pull it out, zip up the curtain.
Yeah.
It'll be done in one day. It's fine.
I mean, with the Windrunners coming to pick them up, they better figure out something, or maybe they can do it back in your Ethereum. I don't know.
Anything I assume else? The Windrunners are going to fly them to the cognitive realm version of your Ethereu, and then Dalinar will open a perpendicularity to get them through.
Yank them through.
Yeah, that's what I assume as well.
And Dalinar's perpendicularities don't just go between physical and cognitive realm. They also touch into the spiritual realm, which is why he was able to speak to Evie. So I assume they'll use that somehow. I don't know exactly how that's going to work.
Yeah. One more thing before we moved on. I just want to say I always appreciate the way that Brandon handles sensitive topics, like Shallan's, like her struggles and what she's going through. He's always very careful with everything that he deals with. It always brings me a little bit of joy just to read that and know he put a lot of thought and care into how he handled that.
I noticed that too, because Shallan and Pattern have a discussion of, well, Pattern says, well, I thought Vale was gone. Didn't we just have a confrontation with Vale and she dissolved into you? And Shallan says, well, yes, but healing's a journey, not a moment, right? And she's at the back of the wagon now, for example. So yeah, I did notice that as well, that Sanderson is broaching the topic well.
While we're on that subject, I think we got finally a concrete answer to the glowing safe in her father's bedroom.
Did we? I missed that.
So what I gathered from that is that she had, you know, because Shallan is not just an unreliable narrator to us, she's an unreliable narrator to herself. And so part of her coping mechanisms is lying to herself. So what I gathered is that she convinced herself that the shard blade she used to kill her mother and stuffed in the safe, that it stayed there and that it was her father's, not hers. And so then whenever she would look at the safe, she'd kind of imagine it glowing with the shard blade still in there as part of her coping mechanism, where she suppressed testament, the idea that it was testament in there. But at the same time, like, testament would have just fizzled out immediately as soon as she shoved it in the safe. And when she went to retrieve the shard blade, when she went to head to Carbranth and chase Yasna around, it says that she stuck her hand in there, instantly summoned testament as a shard blade, and then took it out as if it had already been in there, and then convinced herself it was her father's and she needed 10 hour beats to summon it.
And something else I was thinking of on that same topic is, after that point, testament likely would have looked like a Deadeye shard blade. Like, if her brothers had seen the shard blade, they also would have assumed that it was, you know, their father's. And it's just a normal shard blade, your run of the mill, the Way of Kings, worth 10,000 bromes or whatever. And
did
not
they
like
see
a living blade. If they had, like, when Shallan went to go grab it out of the safe and, you know, instantly summoned it or whatever, at that point, it likely would look like a Deadeye Spren, because she's practically severed her tie to testament. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting point. Which is probably why her shard blade was never described as more unique than any other shard blade was.
Right. Like the blade's not moving and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's not changing shape and it's not glowing, and, you know,
except for in the chasms, it does eventually start to change shape in the chasm, but that, yeah. We may get direct answers to all the odd details about Shallan and her blades, because they do talk about it in this chapter. So we might go back and, you know, revisit details, but I doubt it. I want to talk about Maya real quick. Maya is chatting. Like, I mean, yeah, it was a big moment when she said two words last book, but now she's coming up with sentences, right?
If cannot is one word, she said five, right?
Well, we chose.
Okay.
And what else does she say?
You cannot have my sacrifice.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. So seven.
So maybe seven words. I fully expected that she would not be chatty. This was surprising to me.
I was expecting us to find Baia to Mishram before she's chatty, personally, but apparently not.
Yeah, especially with the time difference. It's not been that long.
I think they are gathering a large number of resources for Brandon to explain to us what happened before the recreants, because we're getting Kalak, who's very chatty, and then now Maya is talking about, yeah, I knew Kalak before. Like, we don't have any spread from before the recreants.
Yeah.
And now, you know, with all the Deadeye Spren waking up, if they can cure them all, like, how much vast amounts of information is just going to get revealed through those Spren talking about it?
Oh, that sounds amazing.
So assuming that, bouncing off that question, assuming they get back to Urithiru like tomorrow or whatever, what happens when Adolin summons his Maia now? Is she going to come out as a sword and start talking like Syl does, or like what's going to happen?
Well, there's another talking sword, so there's precedent.
It's true.
I wonder if he needs to wait to summon her anymore.
Oh yeah.
Needs to revive her. In Oathbringer, even, right? Wasn't it the Battle of Thalen Field? He manages to summon her in like eight heartbeats instead of 10.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now she's much more alive. That's the 10 heartbeats is basically bringing them back to life so that they can enter the physical realm. But if she's, you know, alive and talking in the cognitive realm, maybe she doesn't need that anymore.
I wonder if there'll be a proper like oath between Adolin and Maia, or if it'll just be like they're friends.
Very good question. Half of me wants to say, yes, let's make Adolin an edge dancer. Half of me says, does everyone need to be a Radiant?
Well, and not necessarily like an edge dancer, but what if he just uses Maia as a shard blade and then gives like her a promise specifically, not necessarily an edge dancer oath?
I'd like to see them become something completely different as well. Like
right.
New.
And perhaps something older as well, because the Spren were doing oaths before the Knights Radiant were formed, and they were formed by Ashar doing that binding surge binders with certain protections. So I wonder if this is somehow unlocking something new to us, but really it's something old.
That's really interesting.
Anything else in the Shallan chapter?
Not for me.
Oh, Shallan, or sorry, from our previous episode, when I specifically highlighted that Pattern says, I don't think you'll kill me anymore, the chapter ends with, very well, though, you know, when I said I was sure you wouldn't get me killed? Yes. I should like, he declared, to make a retraction. I think that's quite funny.
It made me laugh.
I think that saves him. do we want to talk
the day
briefly
before retirement?
Do we want to talk briefly about the Ghostbloods as well?
Yeah, Shallan did make the bold claim, maybe arrogant claim, that she was the biggest threat to the Ghostbloods on the planet. And I kind of looked at that and I was like, really? Like, I mean, I get it. Well, I get what you're saying. Like, you've definitely made an enemy here. But really?
By threat, I don't think she means directly. I think she means like threat of exposure. Because if the Ghostbloods got completely exposed, everyone knew who they were, what they could do, and what they were up to, then they can't fight the whole planet of Roshar. And they can't do their subterfuge anymore. So she's a threat to their existence on Roshar, in that she knows a lot of information about them, and they don't like that, and they want to, you know, silence her.
I see that. I think Hoid responding with, yeah, I'll send over my sketches that I have, kind of invalidates that to some extent. But I think she definitely believes that. And I'm sure it will come to play in some way.
Do we think the Ghostbloods will just let her retrieve Do we think the Ghostbloods will just let her retrieve Ba'odomishram and then try to take it from her after that? Or will they like also be trying to go into the spiritual realm?
I'm actually really curious on this. I don't have an answer to your question. I'm really curious how involved the Ghostbloods are going to be in this book specifically. Like, obviously they're a big mover in the Cosmere moving forwards, like with Mist Morn Era 2, Mist Morn Era 3 being titled Ghostbloods. Like, I almost wonder if the Ghostbloods are retreating from, like, after the end of Rhythm of War. And see that they're about to be exposed and just full retreat to Scadrial after this.
So one point that could counter that is in the Lost Metal, which is several years in the future, they do mention that Eatl, the one with the mask, she's still in Roshar. But that doesn't have to mean that the Ghostbloods are still on the same level that they're operating right now.
Twin Soul makes the assumption she's still on Roshar. I'll add that distinction. She may be somewhere else by that point.
Fair point.
They also say no one should be going to Roshar. So
right.
A little bit of a contradiction there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm also curious if they'll be involved. It feels like they're a third wheel at this point. Like, I would be fine if they were just gone for the most part and just stayed out of it. But at the same time, I could see them being a big part of Shallan's plot.
Yeah, I could see also going either way, where they do directly fight or over Ba'eda Mishram, or maybe Shallan just beats them to Ba'eda Mishram, and then they just retreat. Like, they cut their losses and get off Roshar before it all goes haywire.
I also noticed, and this does tie in, if you give me a second, we're getting Scions named now, and more, you know, basically like, this is a Scion, you know what those are, right? He's going to use them more. We also saw Thaidakar use a Scion in the prologue. I'm wondering if Thaidakar is going to get more directly involved in this plot. And we know that he's got a significantly different style than what we've seen from the Ghostbloods on Roshar. So maybe he'll actually be helpful to Shallan in some way, which would take some convincing, but he's good at that.
Yeah, he is good at that. I think that would take a lot of convincing, though.
I mentioned this on the main podcast when we are finishing the Lost Metal, that there's three almost Ghostbloods that I really want to collaborate in the future. I want Shallan, I want Marisi, and I want Shai to be in the same book having a powwow. But by the end of the Lost Metal, Moonlight is in the Ghostbloods, but she's kind of lost herself to her own stamp. Marisi is directly declined to the Ghostbloods, and it would seem that Shallan is directly adversary to the Ghostbloods now. So, not likely to happen.
Yeah.
Can I take a step back and just, because there was something that I think we didn't really touch on too much, but it goes all the way back to the very first epigraph. Was it the first epigraph? The new storm. I don't think they're talking about the Everstorm. I think there's going to be a third storm.
Oh.
Because the wind said to Kaladin in chapter one or two, there's a storm coming and it's the worst yet.
Yeah.
Does I feel Roshar like we kind of flooded? Glossed of, more so than it already has been. it's already got the high storm and the ever storm just making circles clashing with each other once every 10 days or whatever.
Okay. Okay, you're right. So it says perhaps it is the new storm making people reconsider that the wind is not their enemy. But like you said, in the first time we talked to the wind is warning Kaladin about this new storm. And then presumably, if we're making the assumption that Kaladin is writing this, perhaps it is the new storm making people reconsider the wind is not their enemy. So now I have more questions than answers.
It definitely feels like the elephant in the room, and we're going to learn more about this storm, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, this type of question, like we were talking about last episode, could be answered by the next epigraph that we get, right?
Yeah.
True.
That would be helpful.
But the whole point is to speculate and then get answers.
Sure.
Yeah, I always, when I read it, I assumed that it was something to do with the new storm being the Everstorm. People were considering, oh yeah, the the regular storm isn't as bad as we thought. This new storm is like actively evil trying to attack us. But I think what you guys are talking about makes a lot more sense here.
Which way does it go?
Or
we'll read and find out.
Or is it just on all of Roshar all the time?
Yeah, I was gonna say maybe we should do a looser term, a looser use of the word storm, like in the Sunlit Man, right? For half the book, they talk about the storm that's on the other side of the planet, and then what do they call them in that book?
Nomad?
Zellion? Nomad. Nomad at the end of the, or when he shows up, he's like, you didn't tell me it was made of fire. Like, that's an important detail. So, yeah, maybe we should have a looser use of the word storm.
You'd think a Rosharan of all people would know what to label a storm and what not to label a storm, though.
Right. Anything else before we talk about Wit and Kaladin? So this chapter I had read before, or I maybe had read to me before at Dragonsteel, I think. Except with a lot left out. So this whole like Kaladin realizing we're never going to meet again, that whole thing was left out. It was very whimsical, very carefree when it was read at Dragonsteel. It wasn't meant to like panic anybody. That being said, there's some serious involvement in this discussion between Wit and Kaladin. So let me read a couple quotes. "You're talking," Kaladin said, "as if one of us won't survive this." And then a little bit further down, Wit says, "This is the journey, Kaladin, the last part of it. Now practice that flute, get Roshar to listen, help Ishar, but know that you're not coming back to aid Dalinar, whatever he thinks." And then he finishes it with, "Now go. The world needs you to, more than you know. More than you or it or anyone other than your humble Wit yet realizes. The fight ahead of you will be legendary. Unfortunately, you can't fight this one with your strength of muscle. You'll have to wield the spear another way. Good luck." I thought Kaladin was relatively safe until this sentence, until these quotes. What do you guys think?
Don't you have some kind of overarching theory that Kaladin's fifth ideal will be some sort of self-sacrifice, though?
Yeah, but I was talked out of that. Like,
okay,
I was talked out of that because Kaladin sacrificing himself is an oath he could swear today. Like, that's not improving Kaladin at any point. Like, if he could sacrifice himself to save the world, Kaladin would absolutely sign up for that. That's not something he has to like earn. So I don't think, I don't know, maybe with these included, maybe that is part of Kaladin's fifth ideal, is joining the wind or something.
Yeah. So I was just surprised to hear you say that, because I agree. I don't think self-sacrifice is part of Kaladin's fifth ideal, but because he would do that. Page one of Way of Kings.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, I think one little quote you left out is Hoid's response to that, which is, you know, you're talking as if one of us won't survive this. And he's like, I don't know that any of us will survive this. Right.
Yeah.
Now we know that Hoid survives this. So does that mean Kaladin won't, or is Hoid just wrong and trying to prime Kaladin for, you know, expectation wise?
It's also worth mentioning, before I throw it to Tim, we know that this is now discredited Hoid. Hoid knows something's up, and there's something missing in Hoid's memories, right? And this is right after that, within a couple days after that. Hoid hasn't figured it out yet. So this is unreliable narrator Hoid.
Has he ever reliable? More unreliable?
I mean, in Stormlight, I like to think that he's helpful, but maybe not.
I think he's mostly reliable. He's got some twists and some turns, but mostly reliable.
He did tell Dalinar that he'd destroy the whole world if it, you know, got him his goals. So
that's true. He did.
I wonder if technically he even can do that, you know, with his stuff from holding the Dawn Shard.
Right.
He wouldn't do it directly, but, you know, he could manipulate events in his favor. And if that happens to destroy the world, he's like, fine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Anyway, back to this. I think Kaladin's pretty safe. I think what he's getting to is not that Kaladin won't survive this, but just that it's going to take a lot longer than go there, fix him in 10 days, and then come back to help. Like, healing takes longer than that. I think that's the point.
I agree. I think that Dalinar is going to tell him, hey, go there, heal Ishar, come back. Like, we were just talking about that last episode. How are they going to get back in time? And basically, here's Wit saying, they're not going to get back in time. It's almost like he's telling us as readers, don't expect Kaladin's plot to be go there one day, grab Ishar, come back next day, right?
Yeah.
And then be the champion, you know?
Yeah.
There's a quote that I didn't read, which comes after all of what I read, which says, you know what first drew me to you, Kaladin? Wit asked. You did one of the most difficult things a man can do. You gave yourself a second chance. I took that second chance. Maybe a third chance, Kaladin admitted. But now what? Who am I without the spear? Won't it be exciting to find out? Wit said. Have you ever wondered who you would be if there was no one you needed to save, no one you needed to kill? You've lived for others for so long, Kaladin. What happens when you try living for you? I know you can't answer yet. Go and find out. That seems to think that Kaladin will survive this, he just won't return to Dalinar, which is interesting.
Maybe he'll really like Shinnevar and stay there.
Get a cabin.
Get some maybe sheep. He'll like the soil, you know.
True.
Really feel connected, sunk in.
I think he'd have to bring his family with him. I don't think he'd be satisfied if Lirin and Hasina weren't there. And Oridan, of course.
We're assuming that there is a Shinnevar by the end of this book, but
true.
Well, I'm not. Let's back up. I'm not convinced Shinnevar is there to right now. Like, there might be a big puddle of unmade to handle first before Shinnevar even appears.
Yeah. Okay, so how is Kaladin going to use a spear other than the way he has been? Is that metaphorical?
Yeah, I didn't know what almost, that meant.
Yeah, almost definitely metaphorical. Like, Wit just taught him how to use a flute, which is, it's like, this is your new weapon. You're not actually fighting and killing people. You're changing them.
Maybe he needs to consult with Lyft on that one.
Yeah.
Shard fork.
He says a kebab. I mean, it could be as simple as he's teaching other people to use the spear, and that's how he uses the spear. But I don't.
He's done that before.
Yeah, I don't know if that really floats.
That's basically what he's been doing. So this entire time is teaching various groups of people how to use a spear. So.
Teaches his bridgemen, teaches the parchmen, teaches.
He had a squad even before all that.
True. Mm-hmm. Teaches some of the slaves while they're trying to escape. Yeah.
Speaking of the flute, it's almost kind of a meta narrative there when I'm wondering, well, what is the purpose of the flute? And then Wit specifically talks about, well, the purpose of the flute is that there is no purpose, and that is the purpose. I don't know. What do you guys think?
The purpose of the flute is to play the flute.
Right. He does make the explicit wording that the flute, the red flute he holds out to Kaladin and teaches him for an hour here, is the same type of flute, but not the same capacity as the flute he originally gave him. So, what does that mean?
There's something magical about that flute, and I wonder if it's, again, related to connection in some way. And I wonder if, you know, Kaladin will just play a flute sonata in Kirishar or something.
I mean, maybe something about the rhythms.
I'm only half joking.
They're talking about the rhythms of Roshar, not the rhythm of Odium or of the other two. And then later there's this this quote. One of the rhythms of Roshar, Syl said with a nod, made into a song with the tones of the gods. Gods older than yours, Wit said from beside Kaladin on the couch. It's curious that he says gods and not a god. Like Ad nauseam, we've thought is the only one. Maybe it's just semantic difference there, but it seems like what you're talking about with the tones and this power being from Ad nauseam before all of these shards is definitely true.
I singled out the exact same thing, that single S where he says gods. I could come up with theories, but hypotheses really, but they don't mean much. Like maybe Adonalsium was in the habit of splintering himself into various different things, and so they were all like kind of individual gods. Or it could be what you said, where it was just like it made more sense contextually to use the word gods there. I noticed that Wit said hell. That word is not used in this series.
Does he?
He does.
He does.
He says, hell no. Nod that he's not from Roshar.
Yeah, I was going to say, he uses it as an expletive, which for Wit, that's not too surprising.
But anyone on Roshar would say damnation instead of hell. So I just thought I'd point that out. It's like a little bit of a nod to like, Hoi talks more like an earth person than a Rosharian.
He also uses a pretty forceful expletive in this in this chapter in referring to the passions.
Do you want to talk about the passions? I found that whole conversation illuminating and interesting.
I didn't. What did you find illuminating about it? Because I was pretty underwhelmed by it.
So he says the passions are basically based on Odium's religion, right? And the idea is, if you believe something enough, if you feel emotional about it enough, then it will come true. And Hoid's philosophy is, Hoid finds that disturbing and disgusting. He's like, so if a bad thing happens to someone, you're saying it's their own fault for not feeling enough about it, for not wanting it enough. Like, oh, clearly that orphan child, their parents didn't want to live enough for their child, right? It kind of imposes fault on the victim.
Right.
And I think it is illuminating that like Odium kind of has that philosophy and wants to spread that philosophy of the victim is the, you know, to blame for not wanting it enough. Whereas Hoid's philosophy, and one would presume the enemy of Odium's philosophy, would be more along the lines of life is just unfair and you have to accept that. Don't just accept because something sounds nice. Don't just accept it as true. And, you know, it is hard. Life is difficult and you have to work for it. So I thought that was an interesting discussion. I think that that's something Sanderson's kind of putting in there, maybe his own philosophies and beliefs kind of, you know, seeping through Hoid's mouth. But
yeah, I think that happens actually pretty often. Hoid like reflects Brandon pretty closely, but that's me hypothesizing.
Yeah, it's pretty rare though that Sanderson will specifically say, well, I guess it's his character saying this is absolutely wrong. Or like this religion is completely false, but it's Hoid. We don't know how reliable that narrator is. Obviously has a lot more knowledge and information, but it seems like the passions were connected to the old magic in some way. Yeah, I'm curious to learn more about that.
I thought the passions were connected to Odium. Did you see something different?
I missed it. What did Tim just say?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in the chapter it says the passions are from Thalen, or the Thalens follow the passions, and the passions originate from Odium's like pursuit of like hard emotion.
Yeah, the quote is derived anciently from the teachings of Odium.
Okay, you're right. I think with Kaladin's interjection, I assume that it was related to the old magic.
The discussion on hope and Wit like not fully backing up Jasnah, I think was actually an interesting conversation, because Syl brings up Jasnah and says what hope doesn't have much warrant is what Jasnah says, something like that. Maybe I should find the direct quote. Jasnah doesn't believe in hope, Syl whispered. I heard her complaining about it once. Jasnah would make an excellent Wit. She's the right combination of smart and stupid all at once. That's something. Something is horribly wrong. Oh, wait. Something's horribly wrong with said blah, blah, blah. Then they get back to Jasnah. Give me a second. Further down, Wit says, this is where Jasnah is wrong about hope. Smart though she is in many ways. If hope doesn't mean anything to you when you lose, then it wasn't ever a virtue in the first place. It took me a long time to learn that, and I finally did so from the writings of a man who lost every belief he thought he had, then started over new. Which I think is a really cool inclusion here.
Sazed name drop.
Sazed name drop.
Hoyt really yeah. likes Sazed.
And then he says, I hope I get to meet him someday, which I do too. I think that meeting could be cool.
He wrote him a letter. I think this is kind of an extension of what we were just talking about, which is if you're believing something because you think you're going to get something out of it, it's not a virtue. It's an exchange, right? Mm-hmm. It's selfishness. It can't be a virtue unless it exists on its own without the expectation of results or reward or good outcome. And so this is definitely like a clash of philosophies here, even between, you know, Hoyt and Jasnah. So I think this is Sanderson saying, you know, there are these different beliefs out there, but this is what Hoyt believes. That he's kind of touched on this a lot, maybe more cryptically, when he talks about art, where he's like, art should exist because it's art, not because it has utility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And there was another line there that I found surprising. I think Kaladin was thinking offhand about maybe the rumors about Jasnah and Wit were true. I'm assuming that's a break in the relationship. But I think that might have been something that we saw in Rhythm of War. It's been a while since I read it, though.
I took that as the opposite, that they're keeping the relationship secret, but there's rumors.
Yeah, okay. I assume that the rumors that they were in a relationship were true, is what Kaladin is saying.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Anything else?
I do have one last thing. It's an offhand comment about Syl and Spren in general being very interested in Navani and the sibling. I'm very curious about what that is. If it's just, you know, the light coming from that, and therefore Investiture, and maybe somehow they can make use of it. Or if it's something deeper. But I don't think there's anything more to really be said about it.
Let me counter that with something more to be said about it. I had the thought that what if each bondsmith has like a speciality, each of the three, where Dalinar's or the Stormfather's or Honor's, for example, specializes in like the oaths and the ideals and crafting, like, you know, virtue. And then one of the other bondsmith has to do with the Spren and cultivating like a good home for the Spren and making sure they have everything they need, et cetera, et cetera, which would be Navani's place, or maybe the other bondsmith's place. I don't know. But that line, I didn't miss it either. That Syl is like, ooh, Navani, and then runs off and like flies off. It's like she's never done that with Dalinar. There's something very specific about the sibling bondsmith that attracts Spren while they're in the tower or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say that we know that the siblings' biggest issue that they had with Navani was Navani mistreating Spren, in trapping Spren in to make Fabrials, whereas the old method of creating Fabrials was asking Spren to become something. And I wonder if that was what one of the duties of the Tower Bondsmith was to create all of this technology, essentially, by asking Spren to become whatever device it was, including Soulcasters and those healing Fabrials and whatever else. And so, you know, that would explain why no more have been created, you know, since the Radiance, since Malishi or whoever, you know, Malishi was the last Tower Bondsmith. I also kind of think of the sibling, not just of the Spren of the Tower, but also just the Spren of Spren, right? Like the mother of Spren. Mother might not be the right word to use, but
it definitely has that sense of caring for, that you associate with mothering. Or yeah. Cultivation is more like mothering of people. The sibling is the mothering of the Spren.
Yeah, I mean, Shallan uses that term, mother cultivation. So I think using that term isn't inappropriate. So.
I was more just kind of touching on that. The sibling is non-gendered.
Sure. So. Sure. Anything else?
Did I have anything else? I think that's it. How do you think the conversation with Dalinar is going to go?
I'm actually curious if Dalinar heard the Kaladin Wit conversation, because Wit basically just said, don't come back, or you're not coming back. I am curious if Kaladin is then going to share that with Dalinar, or if Dalinar heard that or overheard that. Because I assume Dalinar is going to say, go, this is everything I know about Ishar, go to try to help him. But now I'm also assuming there's going to be a tail end of that conversation of goodbye, potentially. Like, if I don't see you again, here's my blessing, here's how to contact me, et cetera, et cetera.
Here's my number.
Right. Call me, maybe.
Any thoughts, Tim?
Yeah, I'm staring off into the distance thoughtfully, as everyone who's listening on Spotify can tell. I think it'll be more of a standard, hey, you know, Wit seems to think I won't be back in time for the end of this, so good luck. And Dalinar will be like, yeah, well, we'll see. Good luck. And we'll figure this out. Thank you for everything you've done. I appreciate it. And like giving some sense of closure there for whatever may happen at the end, which I think is Dalinar going to serve Odium.
I found it really, actually, it's kind of laugh out loud funny that in the end you discover that Dalinar was just waiting for Wit to be done.
Yeah.
Because from the start, it's implied that Dalinar's stuck in a meeting and then Wit's just killing time with Kaladin. But no, Wit asked for that time with Kaladin. Dalinar's like, I've been waiting an hour.
Dalinar's a busy guy, so.
The only thing I want to point out is the Wind didn't say, listen to Wit. The Wind said, listen to the Bondsmith.
True.
So if Dalinar says, do this and this and this, and Wit, and you know, Wit says, actually, it's going to go this way. Kaladin's supposed to listen to Dalinar.
And Hoid said, listen to the Wind. So yeah. Hoid said, listen to the Wind. The Wind said, listen to Dalinar. And so if Hoid and Dalinar give contradicting messages, he's supposed to listen to Dalinar.
Is the Wind omniscient, though?
I doubt it.
The Wind is experienced. And one would assume extremely knowledgeable about what's going on around the world, because there's always wind everywhere.
True.
So, is the wind trustworthy? What are the wind's goals?
Do you need to fear it?
There's even wind in the tower that's included in the chapter here.
It's true.
I think there are key moments in the series where someone's, especially Kaladin, is propelled by the wind. I have a particularly funny example, which is that Shallan was propelled by the wind to find Yasna, literally in a sailing boat. But still, the wind's pleasure, exactly. So I think that the wind has been around from the beginning and really pushing events forward in nudging.
Yeah,
I like that.
Sometimes more literally than other times. Like, did the wind make sure that the wind's pleasure made it to Carbranth in good time so that Yasna wouldn't have left by then?
Well, but then you could also make the argument, did the wind make sure that the pirate or that the ghost bloods got on the ship to kill Yasna? Like,
maybe that was important. Yasna maybe that was
part of the plan. I don't know.
I still want to know if something's controlling the great shells.
Yeah. The Santhins. We never really got answers to that. All right. Let's close it there and reconvene with whatever we get next week. Thanks for joining me, Tim and David.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Have a great week.